Come on in.
Get real close, because you're listening to Snap Judgment, the podcast.
All right.
Get ready. Welcome to Snap Judgment from NPR, the show about the decisions people make that change everything. My name is Glenn Washington, and today, before we get started, can I get something to ease my throat, Mr. DJ Man? What? That's it? Hit me? And I feel a lot better. Back by popular demand, DJ Smooth Grooves on the ones and twos. Now, I'm guilty. People are busy. We have lots of important stuff to do. Appointment with the hairdresser. Gotta get the car fixed. Taxes due. Whose night is it to fix dinner anyway? This stuff, day in, day out. We spend our time doing this stuff, this stuff, this stuff. But every once in a while, we're doing this stuff. Boom. The bomb drops, everything's shaking up, and all this stuff we're up to doesn't seem to matter anymore. We drop everything. Today on Snap Judgment, the show about the decisions people make that change everything, we drop everything. First up, Snap Judgment regular contributor Jeff Greenwald likes to mind his own business, but when he jumps, he jumps.
There are two things you need to know about Jeff Greenwald in order to understand this story. The first is that he has always had this feeling, this vision, that at some point in his travels, be it Cleveland, Ohio, or trekking the Himalayas, at some point, he was going to find a gold ring.
And it'll have a really special significance, because when I find this gold ring, I'll put it on my finger and I'll know that it's a message from the powers that be that my spiritual quest has come to fruition, that I found what I'm looking for in the spiritual realm.
So that's point one, gold ring. Put that in your head. Lock that in. All right. Item number two in our prelude is, what happened to Jeff when he went to the Ajanta Caves in Aurangabad, India?
The Ajanta Caves were built between 200 and 650 AD. And there's about 20 caves in all, filled with paintings that, because of the darkness and the closed nature of the caves, are preserved and look almost as gorgeous as they did when they were first painted almost 2,000 years ago. So I went down to Ajanta, and I'm wandering through the caves, and I'm looking at all these scenes painted on the wall. And these are scenes from what are called the Jataka Tales. And the Jataka Tales are as well known in India and in Asia as the Walt Disney stories are known here in the U.S. These are the stories of Buddha's past life. Because before Buddha was the Buddha, he had a life of every kind of animal and insect that you can imagine. He was a deer. He was the king of the monkeys. He was a fish. He was a meditator in a cave somewhere in the mountains. He was a bird. He was every kind of animal and creature you could imagine. And these stories tell all the different tales of the wonderful things that the being that would become Buddha accomplished in his past lives. So I was walking from room to room in the Ajanta cave temples, actually walking from cave to cave, because there are all the rooms are caves that were carved from the living rock. And I came into this one room, and there was a mural on the wall. And it was a mural of a scene from the actual life of Buddha, where Buddha has decided to renounce everything. He rode his horse to the river Anoma, and he met a woodcutter there. He traded clothes with a woodcutter, cut off all of his hair. The Buddha cut off his long royal locks of hair, and then put on the woodcutter's simple clothes, said farewell to the horse, and crossed the river and began his quest to become the awakened one. And I looked at this scene of all the characters in this scene as Buddha's about to leave and renounce the world, and I looked at the imagery and I suddenly recognized myself in one of the characters in that mural. And this wasn't just a casual sense of, oh, I knew who that was. It was this absolutely overwhelming sense that I saw myself. I saw who I had been 2,500 years ago during the lifetime of the Buddha.
You, the skeptic, were skeptical no longer. You recalled your past life. The scales had fallen from your eyes and you remembered what happened 2,500 years before when you were with the Buddha.
I still thought reincarnation was a load of hooey. But I couldn't deny that having seen this image and having recognized myself in this mural, this flood of memories had come back to me.
And boom, Jeff's life changed forever.
I didn't know what to do with it. It really worked against my whole worldview. The impact was so gigantic that a few weeks later, as soon as I got back to the United States, I began writing down all these memories that spontaneously arose to me from that lifetime. I remembered everything that had happened to me during those years, 25 centuries ago, and I wrote in great detail about my relationship with the characters in that scene and what it had felt like to be on the banks of the River Enoma that afternoon so long ago.
That's item number two. So to sum up, one, Jeff will someday find a gold ring and his purpose will be revealed. And two, Jeff saw himself crossing the river with the Buddha in a painting in the Ajanta Caves in India. So that's two things, but actually there's a third one, and it involves a deal Jeff made with his friend Sally.
And we had an agreement. If one of us ever found the Buddha anywhere in our travels, we would let the other person know. The other one would drop everything and come out to see if this were true. We would actually not even to see if it were true. We would take the other friend at their word. If Sally ever called me and said, Jeff, I've met the Buddha, you have to come, I would go. And that's exactly what happened. Sally called me in 1993. She was in Lucknow, India, and said, I've met this guy. His name is Papaji. He's the real thing. I want you to come out here. You can't miss it. And I dropped what I was doing, and I got on a plane, and I flew to Delhi, and then I took the train to Lucknow.
She better not have been messing around. If you're going to go all that way, she had better come correct with the goods. You want to see Buddha.
She only had one chance to get this right. She couldn't ask me twice to come see the Buddha. She could only do it once. And this is when she decided to do it.
Drop everything. I have found the Buddha.
So I arrived in this little town of Indiranagar, and I met Sally. And she started telling me about this guru she had found. And his name, his real name was Harilal Punja, though he went by the nickname of Papaji. Everyone called him Papaji. And as I got to know more about this fellow, I realized that he really did pass all the kind of internal tests I had for a great spiritual leader. He never accepted any money from any of his followers. He would only accept flowers or candy or books of poetry. He lived in a simple house on a dusty corner in Indiranagar and drove a little Maruti minivan around. He had wonderful relationships with his disciples, but he didn't have any what you'd call improper relationships. He was a big strapping guy who'd been a wrestler, and some people told me that during the 1940s he had even been something of a terrorist, blowing up trains and fighting for Punjabi independence. Every morning at about 10, Papaji would give what he called satsang, truth saying, where he would sit in a room with his 100 or 200 or 300 followers, whoever was there that day, and he would read letters from the audience, and he would advise people what to do based on their predicament. Not only did he give wonderful advice, but Papaji had this great gift that you find in some of the real spiritual masters in India. He could do this technique, I believe it's called Nirdir Dakshina, enlightening with the eyes. All your cares would melt away, and in that instant of engagement with him, you would see all the way through, and you would become enlightened in an instant. This finger-snap enlightenment with the eyeballs was something that Papaji had mastered, and I watched as one devotee after another went up on stage and had their questions answered, and some, for the lucky few, Papaji would look them in the eye, and they would break down into spontaneous laughter, or throw their arms in the air, and start just singing out of this sheer feeling of jubilation of having been even momentarily liberated. There are many wonderful stories about things that Papaji did when people wrote him letters. One particular story really stands in my mind. It was a woman who really wanted to stay in Indiranagar and study with Papaji, but she had this terrible, crippling phobia of dogs. Now, if you've ever been to India, you know that the streets are full of dogs, and some of them are very gentle, of course, but others can be unpredictable. And if you have a fear of dogs, just walking to your flat at night or walking out to breakfast in the morning can be an extremely harrowing experience. And the woman wrote a note to Papaji and went up on stage and started to talk to him about it. So Papaji read her letter and he said, you have a fear of dogs. It's very inconvenient here in India. I have an idea, but I can't really do anything for you right now. Come back tomorrow. And when the woman came in the next day, Papaji called her up onto the stage, onto the dais where he sat, and he gave her a box. And inside the box was a newborn puppy for her to raise. And I remember just looking at him and looking at the expression on that woman's face and thinking, this guy is like King Solomon. He really is an enlightened master. After I'd been at the satsang for 2 or 3 days, maybe it was a week, some of Papaji's closest followers came up and surrounded me as I sat in the lunchroom eating some rice and curry. And they said, Sally tells us that you're a journalist from the United States. And I said, yes, I'm a writer and journalist. I've written some books and I do a lot of interviews. And they said, well, we have a proposition for you. Papaji has said that he would like to do a video interview that will be shown on Indian television. It would take about 2 hours. We need somebody who's willing to ask him really probing questions and be on camera for this period of time. Would you be comfortable being that interviewer? And I thought to myself, wow, what an honor. This is great. And I turned to them and I said, I'd love to do it. Let me come up with a sheet of questions.
So Jeff started writing questions, probing every rumor. Was it true, really true, that Papaji used to be a professional wrestler? Was he really a Punjabi freedom fighter? All the questions amounted to really one single question for Papaji. Who are you? Jeff Greenwald was ready. The stage was set for an interview with the man thousands of followers believed to be the living Buddha.
I walked into the Satsang Hall the next evening, and the place was just packed. There were 3 video cameras set up with technicians standing around each one. The stage was awash in lighting and covered with flowers. All of Papaji's devotees had brought him bouquets of flowers, which were all over the stage, making it look like a, more of a wedding than an interview. And we sat down together, facing each other, and I began asking him questions about himself and his life. And he laughed, and he turned to the audience, and he played so well off the questions, and he was so clear, and I was just sitting there thinking to myself, this is amazing. How did I ever get lucky enough to be into this situation where I'm sitting there interviewing a living Buddha in front of hundreds of people? What kind of weird karma has led me to this moment? And I was asking Papaji about one of the main questions that haunts spiritual seekers, which is, how do you take what you've learned in a spiritual context? How do you take the lessons that you get from a spiritual master and bring them into the real world? It's so hard to live a life as a layperson and yet really try to have any kind of spiritual orientation. And in answer to the question, Papaji turned to me and he started telling me a story. And I was surprised because it was actually the exact same story that I had seen 10 years ago in that mural in the Ajanta Caves. It was the exact same story of how the Buddha, when he decided to reach the awakened state, had to leave his palace at Kapilavastu and ride his horse to the river Enoma, cut off his hair, get rid of his clothes, and abandon everything. And Papaji just stood there describing the whole scene in amazing detail, just as it had been in that mural in Ajanta. And then he leaned over and he put his hand over the microphone, and Papaji leaned over to my ear, and he looked him in the eye, and he said to me, I think you remember. I think we were there. And he fixed me with his gaze. And at that moment, it was as if the entire fabric of space-time unraveled like a sweater caught on a thorn bush. For a split second that expanded into an unknown amount of time, all of eternity seemed like one moment. And I saw my life not as myself, as Jeff sitting there in the chair. I saw every place I had ever been and everyone I had ever known as if it had happened at the same instant. And I looked into Papaji's eyes and I knew that I had known him for centuries, that he had been there at the banks of the river Enoma with me when he had been the Buddha and I had been his horse.
What? His horse.
It seemed that we stared in each other's eyes forever, but I must have blacked out. Something must have happened, because the next thing I remember is Papaji's hand on my shoulder, shaking me, saying, "Come back, come back, we have an interview to finish," and everyone in the satsang hall laughing and rocking back and forth, and the lights in my eyes, and Papaji laughing, and his hand on my shoulder, and I opened my eyes, and that moment, that instant, was somehow gone, and yet I knew it would always be with me for the rest of my life. After the interview ended and the cameras started to roll away, Papaji and I left the stage. He was immediately surrounded by his hundreds of followers, all of whom just hugging him and holding him, tears rolling down their cheeks, telling him how profound the interview had been and how much it had moved them. I walked out alone, and as I walked through the hall and out of the satsang and into the street, I heard a voice behind me calling, "Wait, wait, Jeff, please wait." And I turned around, and there was a man, a very beautiful-looking man who I knew as Thomas, who had been to many of the satsangs with me, and I hadn't really ever spoke to him, but now he looked at me in a way that just seemed so intimate that I'd really never experienced anything like it. And he walked up to me, and he said, "Jeff," he said, "you and I have never really met before, but as you were up there speaking with Papaji, I realized that for many, many years and many lives, you and I have been brothers. And to make that clear," he said, to show you that I'm absolutely certain that this is true, I have something to give you." And he reached one hand into the other and pulled off the gold ring he was wearing on his finger, and he handed it to me. "I can't take this," I said. "You have to take it," he said. "It already belongs to you. If you don't want it, just leave it on the ground. But it's yours, and has always been yours from the moment I saw it." I took the ring and I looked at it, and I understood what it meant. And the ring, Glenn, remains on my finger.
That's the ring.
This is the ring.
That's it.
See, I like that story. I like that story so much that we had to put some special things together on the website. Check it out at snapjudgment.org. Jeff Greenwald is the author of Scratching the Surface. And jeffgreenwald.com has various things. We'll have a link to it at our website. But let us know your story. And we might just give you the snap judgment treatment, baby. But stay tuned, because next up, we're about to go to the Middle East. Snap judgment spares no expense. And stuff is going to happen. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Snap Judgment. I'm Glenn Washington, and I'm going to need a little traveling music for this one. Got to get my passport ready, my walking shoes on, because you know what? You know what? Most people need to be prodded a little bit before they start making those major moves. You got to poke them, bite them, stick them with something sharp. But there are those times when the universe catches us waiting, when the slightest puff of wind sends us spiraling towards a series of choices we never imagined. Now, you've heard of Alibaba and the 40 Thieves or Aladdin. Well, we're about to go to the heart of the Middle East. Snap Judgment's own Rita Daniels looks behind the veil and gives us a real-life, modern-day fairy tale.
Once upon a time, Simone was in a land far, far away. She's been traveling for 2 days. Simone flew from San Francisco to Frankfurt, 11 hours, and then waited in the airport for 6 hours to board her 4-hour flight to Beirut. And when she gets to Beirut, she'll have a 2-hour car ride to get to the Syrian coast. And the whole time, she has to make sure that the floor-length dress she's carrying remains wrinkle-free. Her best friend Sarah is getting married to a Syrian guy, and Simone's going to the wedding. Simone is not supposed to be traveling alone. She was supposed to be traveling with the guy that she was supposed to be marrying. But they just broke up.
And I was basically heartbroken and devastated and a bit vulnerable, shall we say.
Now Simone is alone, going halfway across the world carrying a fancy dress. And she's not the one getting married. On the flight to Beirut, Simone meets Abdul. He's a Lebanese businessman who works in Germany.
Tall, dark, and handsome, basically.
He's going home to see the family. He buys her a couple of mini bottles of Sky vodka and asks the stewardess for extra tonic.
He owned a car dealership and dealt in very high-end cars and Ferraris and Porsches.
Nice.
Yeah, I thought nice.
Abdul loves her beautiful eyes. They laugh for 4 hours. It's very romantic. And then the plane lands, and Simone kisses Abdul goodbye. Beirut, Lebanon. The airport. The car waiting to take Simone to Syria is not there. It's 4 a.m.
What do? I'm looking around. I feel alone and isolated in a totally foreign environment. And all I saw was Abdul meeting his family. And there's about 12 of them there to meet him, and they're all embracing each other. He looks over at me for the last time before leaving, it gives me one last chance. Do you want to come with me?
Simone is captivated.
It felt wonderful just to be wanted in that moment. And I take a deep breath and I think, oh my God, here we go. This is going to be a great adventure.
Maybe this is it. Maybe this will be the beginning of her happy ending.
And I said, yes, I want to go. I was terrified, but I wanted to go.
Abdul drives Simone through the countryside.
We watch the sun come up. We finally arrive to where we're getting to, and it's this very rocky area. You couldn't even hike down there with shoes on. We really had to take off our shoes and use our fingers and our toes to hike down these rocks and get to this house.
Abdul brings Simone to the inner sanctum of his people, deep in the heart of rural Lebanon.
They were just so warm and welcoming to me. They made me feel more welcome than my own family, frankly. I've just felt absolutely adored. It was a very nice, warm feeling.
The next day, Abdul accompanies Simone to her friend's wedding. Another long, beautiful drive together.
On our way to the wedding in a taxi, he asked me to marry him.
Simone has known this man for 2 days. She's a sensible woman. She's just been through a breakup. She knows exactly what she should say.
I said yes.
Actually, that wasn't the answer I was thinking of.
I was completely swept up off my feet. We're on our way to a wedding, and we're already engaged. So we're in this big, wonderful, beautiful Syrian wedding. I could guess maybe 200 or 300 people. A lot of dancing, a lot of food, a lot of music, a lot of laughs. I was in love.
Simone and Abdul leave the wedding. They hold hands on the entire ride back to his home. And when they arrive, Abdul announces to the entire family that the next day, when the couple has known each other for 3 days,
they're going to get married. And his family was absolutely elated, jumping up and down. They go nuts. Everybody's hugging each other. It's just a big room full of love.
So the next day, Simone marries Abdul.
So here I am, and we're about to spend our first night together in the same room. The family had decorated the room and had lit incense and had opened the windows and closed the curtains, and this was our first romantic encounter. So we closed the door.
Simone looks deep into her new husband's eyes. "My family," he says, "is very supportive of this marriage."
You could hear a low hum in the next room.
For Abdul's family, the wedding night is sacred. It's a time for prayer.
They were singing and chanting, and he tells me my family is praying that we're going to make a baby. They're praying in the next room that we're going to make a baby right now. 30, 40 members of this new family all cheering us on. We had an audience. It was very exciting.
Simone and Abdul spent a night of wedded bliss together. They were very, very happy. For 3 or 4 days,
Abdul and I have our first fight. And I notice in this argument, he's not very concerned about the way I feel, hands me the equivalent of about $20 in cash and says, "Oh, go with my sisters to this theme park. That'll make you feel better. Go on a roller coaster." I'm trying to be the good new wife, but I'm quickly realizing that my cares and concerns are not exactly welcome. We never really came to a good common ground, and quickly, I would say day by day, became more and more aware that we were maybe not so well suited.
One night, Abdul's cousin pulls Simone aside and tells her some sobering news.
Well, his car dealership turned out to be a side-of-the-road place where he and his friend fixed up used cars and sold old junkers.
What? No Porsche? No Ferrari?
And I realize I've really been taken for a ride at this point. Things had been kind of in a rapid state of collapse day by day. The family's having a meltdown with each other and with him. He and I are having a meltdown. The relationship's starting to disintegrate.
Abdul and Simone had gotten married in the middle of August. August 2001.
We're walking out of a cafe one day, and a young boy of maybe 9 or 10 came up to us and starts relentlessly kind of shouting, "New York, Bomba, New York, Bomba," over and over and over again. And he's crying and weeping and screaming this at us. I say, "I need to see the news. I need to see some kind of news right away to find out what's happened." And I see the Twin Towers.
And when she saw those towers on TV, that's when reality finally hit home.
All of my illusions were quickly shattered.
This marriage is not going to work.
I've got to go. I've got to go home. I had headed back to the United States.
Simone had given up her fairy tales and went home to join the real world, along with everybody else.
Please maintain control of your baggage at all times. Report suspicious activity or unattended bags by calling 911 on any airport telephone. Check with your air carrier for any changes in items that may be carried through the security screening checkpoint.
That piece was produced by Rebecca Hertz and Rita Daniels. And thank you, Simone, for sharing your story with The Snap. It had everything. International intrigue, mystery, lust, passion. And if you out there, dear listener, have a story for us, please let us know at snapjudgment.org.
You'll be able to share your own story and listen to others. And while you're at snapjudgment.org, check out the movies, the podcasts, stories from snappers all over the globe. Facebook, of course. Twitter, you know we tweet. You know we do this. You'll find out on the site that we are, in fact, a great big Snap Judgment family. Families care about each other. Families look out for each other. Myself and senior producer Mark Ristich go way back. Way back, in fact, to Detroit. And we're in Oakland now, but we're from Detroit. A part of our soul is there. And when you get that family phone call, you know it's drop everything time.
It died in the...
Everybody knew that Grandma Rose was going to die. Except for Grandma Rose. She didn't really want to die. She was 95, but she was still living life. She wanted to go down to Wheeling, West Virginia, see her sisters, hang out. She had plans. But the body gives up on you. And when we got the call, drop everything, come home, we did. We went to Detroit. We went to the hospital, and there she was. A skinny woman all her life, she was now twice the size. Her lungs were filling with water. She was wearing a mask, an oxygen mask, and she was just wheezing away. Well, Grandma Rose was not going to die in the hospital. No way. That's not how we do it. We had a plan. We were going to take her home. She would gently ease into death, looking out at her wildflower garden, at her own home. The hospital was cool with this, too. My mom was at the house with the nurse. I'm in the hospital with my aunt, the one that was by her side every day for 2 years, and she's on the verge of tears, so the doctors are coming to me, and they're asking me to sign stuff. Do you have her medication? Check. Do you realize that you are taking her out of our care and signing her into hospice? Check. Check. Whatever it is, just give me my grandmother. And they do. Big EMS guys come and wheel her away. My aunt rides in the ambulance and I follow behind her. We get to the tree-lined lane, and all hell breaks loose. The EMS guys are running around and they can't stabilize her. She can't breathe. The oxygen meter that said 95 in the hospital is dropping. 93, 92, it starts beeping. 89, 87, she is going to die now. Where's the nebulizer? It's over there. Where's the medicine for the nebulizer? What? The prescriptions. We didn't order them. We asked the hospice nurse, what's going on? She says, this is not our fault. So we don't care whose fault it is. Can you fix it? The EMS guys come to me. Look, if we can't stabilize her, we're going to have to take her back to the hospital. I'm like, no way. We didn't get her this far to have her die in a hospital. Make it happen. They come back with a little canister of high-flow oxygen. They pop it on, and Grandma chills out. 87, 89, that's it. High-flow oxygen, 15 PSI, same as in the hospital. Now, next to Grandma's bed, we got three big, gigantic kegs of oxygen. But the EMS guys say it's the wrong PSI. 6 PSI. 6 frickin' PSI. So we ask the hospice nurse, what's up with the oxygen? She says, it's not our fault. It came from medical supply. Then the hospice nurse says, look, maybe some morphine will help calm her down. My aunt Eleanor is livid. She says, we need her prescriptions right now. The nurse says, are you denying her morphine? I said, hey, can't we get her 15 PSI containers? It looks like it works. She says, I don't know. I'm not a respiratory therapist. Well, EMS comes back and says, hey, looks like she's stabilized. We can go. I said, she's still wheezing and she looks like she's in a lot of pain. They said her oxygen level's okay. So we try to calm down and I tell my aunt, look, let's just let the nurse do her job. So the nurse fills out some paperwork. Okay. And she talks on the phone. Okay. And then a half hour goes by and we're dying, curious. Have you ordered the prescriptions yet? No. Well, 15 minutes pass and we ask her again. Have you ordered the prescriptions? She says, no. And then my Aunt Eleanor loses it, freaks out. She is full of silent venom, huffing, puffing, muttering, sputtering, and then she blurts it out. And it's not even that bad, but she does blurt it out. She says, "My mother is dying, and we have to deal with this clown." That's it. Clown. What? You heard what I said. Remember, I'm here to help. Oh, really? When does that start? The nurse steps back, and she tears up. She starts crying, and she says, "This is workplace abuse." That's when the battle of the cell phone starts. Everybody goes to a private corner of the house. My aunt calls hospice. She says, "I want a new nurse." The nurse calls hospice. She says, "I don't have to take this abuse." Minutes later, the nurse comes back in. "In all my years, I have never left a bedside, but I'm being let go." We act real sad. I give her a hug. I walk her out to the car. But we won. And then hospice calls us back. They will not send a new nurse. They say, "Your aunt is abusive." I said, "You have to. You signed a contract." They said, "You fired our nurse. The contract ended." "My grandmother is dying." They said, "If she's dying, call 911. Call 911. Please send a new nurse." They said, "Are you willing to talk to a social worker?" A social worker? I have a woman in the next room wheezing and dying in pain. Can we talk to the social worker later? They said, "We'll let you know.
We'll let you know."
Now I am furious. I walk out of the bedroom and I almost punch a picture of my Aunt Jewel. And then the doorbell rings. And it's an 18-year-old kid with two monster tanks of high-flow 15 PSI oxygen. And I'm like, "Dude." And then in behind him walks this real blasé middle-aged guy, Dockers, blue shirt. And he shakes my hand and he says, "Hi, I'm a respiratory therapist." And he breaks it down. He says, "Look, man, these EMS guys, they're cowboys. They don't know what they're talking about. It's 15 PSI at the hospital. It's 6 PSI in the home. But it's all about the mask. And the mask says 50% oxygen. It's not about the PSI." I'm like, "Really?" And then, minutes later, in walks the real Angel of Mercy, the new hospice nurse from the new hospice company. And she is the real deal. We love her, and she loves us right back. She says, "Look, your grandmother is dying. You don't have to freak out about a nebulizer. We're just here to manage the pain." So we order a pizza. And at midnight, I go home to my brothers to get some sleep. But I get home, and my mom's on the phone. It's over. Grandma Rose is gone. And in her final minutes, she opened up her eyes. She stared at her two daughters at the foot of the bed, looked out the picture window, passed away.
Leży, leży Jezus malusieńki, leży, leży Jezus na gusieńki, hej, hej, Jezus na gusieńki. Zdjęła panna swój rąbeczek z głowy, ściele w żłóbku panu Jezusowi, hej, hej, panu Jezusowi. Annajże, drogie serce moje, bo cię kocham tak jak życie swoje, hej, hej, tak jak życie swoje.
Rest in peace, dear lady. Rest in peace. You're listening to Snap Judgment. My name is Glenn Washington, and you might not know this, but both executive producer Mark Ristich and myself hail from the Motor City, hail from Detroit, Michigan. And though people speak badly of our hometown, We both harbor extremely fond memories. My own grandparents were there. One of my favorite memories coming up was as a young boy, 6 years old, going to the store and buying a six-pack of beer and some cigarettes. I got to keep the change for video games, and I appreciated it. Coming up next, I tell my own Detroit story. I'm going to get ready. Don't you worry, none. Snap Judgment. Storytelling with a Beat. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Snap Judgment. I'm your host, Glenn Washington, and on today's show, we're dropping everything. Stories about that time in everybody's life when everything had to go. They had to make a different decision and go a different direction. I've got a special story of my own I need to share, but first I gotta get changed. I gotta freshen up. I gotta put on my special storytelling shoes. Maybe the Snap Judgment Singers were taken away from me for just a minute until I get back. Snap Judgment Singers, if you please.
Snap Judgment Radio.
Okay, so I was broke. That's what unemployment will do to you. So when my boy said he could get me a job at one of the biggest, fanciest accounting firms on the planet, I said, hook that mess up with a quickness. I told you I was broke. I didn't know anything about accounting. So he said to call Mr. Happy right away. Mr. Happy said, come on in for an interview. I put on my suit, put on my tie, shine my shoes, and Mr. Happy welcomed me with open arms. He said, don't you worry about all that accounting mumbo jumbo. We can teach all that. Mr. Happy said, the most important thing was a keen mind, willing to fight and fight hard for the client. Could I be the keen mind he was looking for? Could I? Yes, sir, I can. Good. He told me to report to Mr. Sad right away. Mr. Sad said, you have a lot to do. I assume you have a strong accounting background. I said that'd be an incorrect assumption. Mr. Sad looked sad. He said, that means we're going to have to start at the very beginning. He said, you've got to understand the numbers before you understand anything. Mr. Sad left the room and came back with several really, really big sheets of ledger paper. Now, the numbers for the company are right here in this folder. I'm going to read them out to you, and I want you to write them down on this piece of paper. Mr. Sad started reading numbers. I started writing down. 1,563, 27,004, 17,35,000. We went like this for a while. And Mr. Sad said, okay, now we have to add all this stuff up. And I was like, okay, all right. 15, 18, 23, carry the one, add the two, whatever. It was confusing because there was a lot of numbers, but I checked it again. And I wrote my answer down. Mr. Sad said,
six.
I don't think that's the right answer. He looked down at his page, looked at my page, said, see here, you wrote the number down wrong. That's 3604, not 3404. Oh. You check those numbers one more time, and I'm going to be right back.
Well, that's when I got serious. This was my new profession. I was going to take this seriously. I was checking the numbers again when Miss Anxious came into the room. She looked at my big piece of paper. She looked at me. She closed the door. And she said, "What in the hell do you think you're doing? Well, and where did you even get this paper? Look, Mr. Sags, I was supposed to..." She looked at me like I was her enemy from a long time ago. "Look, look, maybe you really are this stupid. But there's a program on your laptop you were issued. It's called Excel. You don't sit at a table with your pencil and your eraser like an idiot." "Well, Mr. Sad, do you know that Mr. Sad is a crazy person? Now, I'm going to open this door now, and I don't ever want to see this type of nonsense again. Do you understand?" Her eyes were spinning and unstable. "I understand.
Foremen, bookkeepers, everybody has to spend more time on paperwork."
See, I was missing something basic, and I did realize it. But I couldn't ask anybody or there was going to be trouble. I looked up Excel on the internet, and Mrs. Anxious was right. Excel was, in fact, a very popular program, and it was installed on my computer, just like she said. But when I called it up, it was just a big graph. I started typing numbers and words, but nothing was really happening. I was messing around with it when Mr. Happy snuck up behind me and put his hand on my shoulder. He said that Mr. Sad had nothing but good things to say about my work on the project. "Uh-huh. You'll find the reward initiative around here. That's why you need to analyze this." He had a huge folder, several inches thick, and dropped everything on my desk.
Paperwork explosion.
It was a tax file for a major automobile subsidiary. And you have to understand, I can't fill out my own 1040EZ form. This was the tax documentation for a major U.S. corporation, a towering stack of numbers. "So I'm going to need you to go through this with a fine-tooth comb. Tell us what you think the implications are and any strategies we should employ going forward." I couldn't feel my hands. "We'll check back in a couple weeks and see what you've got." Mr. Happy disappeared down the hall. I stared at the stack. I didn't touch it. It might fall down. I didn't touch it. I stared. At 6:30, I got up, I turned off my cubicle light and went home. Bright and early, 8:30 the next morning, I sat down. I looked up at the stack. I didn't touch it. I got back there at 8:30 the next morning. I sat back down at the desk and stared up at the stack. I didn't touch it. I couldn't. Again, I went home at 6:30 p.m. and arrived the next morning. Days passed like this. Weeks. Torturous. Every time a set of footfalls approached, I knew it was the executioner. This time, the footfalls that came down the hall were different. Purposeful. Poof. 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 The hand rested on my shoulder. Mr. Happy, it was all over.
"I've got some bad news," said Mr. Happy. "Now, I know how hard you've been working on this, but, well, the client decided to go in a different direction. Nothing to be done about it." "Really sorry about that." Feeling washed over my extremities. I was saved. I shook my head. "Well, we'll make it work next time."
"That we will," said Mr. Happy. "That we will."
Days passed. I didn't feel Mr. Happy's touch on my shoulder for a long while.
But then I did. Glenn, could you walk with me for a moment? Sure. What's going on? Well, you know. He directed me towards the Human Resources Department. Mr. Happy looked sad. The lady asked me to have a seat. Mr. Happy sat down as well. She said, they felt it was time to sever our employment arrangement. She said there had been some concern that maybe I wasn't such a good fit. She handed me a box of tissues. Mr. Happy took one. We're going to have to ask you to vacate the premises today, she said. Mr. Happy said, sorry about that. They said they had some paperwork for me to fill out, but I could send that in later. I left the room, and various people surrounded me. Tough break, they said. Tough break. I drove home. I went to the sink and poured a tall glass of water. I drank it all down with one pull. Then I packed everything I owned into the back of my Honda Civic. I dropped the apartment keys in the manager's mailbox. I started driving to California. I was still broke, but as hard as I tried, the smile would not stay off my face. Yes, you have reached the end of the show. DJ Smooth Groove is already pouring drinks. And if you're thinking, what, that's it? Well, looky here, Miss I Can Do Better. If you've got storytelling chops and you've got something on your mind, let us know on thesnapjudgment.org. The Snap Judgment storyline, the telephone, 888-304-SNAP. And don't forget, the brand new Snap Judgment iPhone application, free on the internet. And you might find this funny, but Snap Judgment was produced by myself, Glenn Washington. But did I mention Uber producer? Mark Ristich, senior producer, God of War and Radio, Roman Mars. Nothing happens around here without Rebecca Hertz saying something about it, calling it names, pointing the crack snap. Judgment crew, Ben Bercasio, Rita Daniels, Will Urbina, and Sarah Jesse. If you are out there in the world with extra love to give, please aim it at the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Much love to them. Snap Judgment is powered by those mad geniuses at Media Cannon. Don't sleep on PRX, the Public Radio Exchange, and even though this is certainly not the news. In fact, you could build a rocket ship, fly to the moon, dig a hole at the bottom of a crater, and you would still not be further from the news than we are. This is NPR. The producer of this very podcast, listening, judging, and condemning all she hears out of my mouth right now is Snap Judgment's own podcast producer, Rita Daniels.